Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, you can build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic, personalized closet. And the styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out for more new-to-you styles. So I've been using Armoire and I'm actually wearing one of their shirts right now as I'm recording this, and it's a great idea. You don't have to commit to buying the clothes, but you can really start to explore your own personal style. Like if there's a trend or something that you've been wanting to maybe try but not commit to, this is absolutely perfect. Because if you don't like it, you just put it back in the bag and get something else. Because we've all been there. You open your closet, and even though it's packed, you feel like you have nothing to wear. And with Armoire, that's a thing of the past. They make it effortless for all women to turn heads with stylish everyday looks. You can rent high-quality designer clothing for any occasion, and it's all tailored to your personal style. Plus, you don't have to do laundry, and you don't have to go shopping. It truly could not be any easier. And right now, my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month, which is up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/ATTWG. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/ATTWG to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today. We sleep better when we sleep cool. As the weather is getting warmer, staying cool while we sleep will be top of mind. Organic and natural bedding sleeps cooler than cheaper synthetic alternatives, and they last longer too. A fresh season calls for a fresh start, and that includes your bed. From seriously soft organic cotton sheets to breathable silk and luxurious down duvets, Avocado Green's bedding makes it easy to reset your space sustainably. Perfect for hot sleepers in warmer months, Avocado Green sheets and duvet inserts are naturally breathable and help regulate temperature, so you sleep cool, dry, and comfortable all night long. Avocado bedding is thoughtfully designed and expertly crafted for lasting durability. From reinforced stitching to premium long staple organic fibers, every detail is made to stand the test of time, wash after wash, season after season. We sleep better when we sleep cool, so head to avocadomattress.com today to save 10% on all bedding and 50% on clearance bedding. Avocado, dream of better. With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom? Let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send her a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you wish to ask. And then she can either type a response or use their voice-to-text feature, and MyLifeInABook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and stories for eternity. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy. It's something that you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. And this is something that Ethan and I had been thinking about doing with our parents. We have this podcasting equipment, so we wanted to find a way for them to tell their story. But I love this because it's so regimented. They send them a question every week, and it just makes it really easy and turnkey. And it just seems like a great way for us to get our parents' stories down so that our children and our children's children can have them. So if you're interested, check out MyLifeInABook.com and use code ATTWG at checkout for 15% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use code ATTWG for 15% off today. On the morning of April 29th, 2003, Beau Tudors woke his daughter Tabitha up for school and put her favorite TV show on. He said goodbye as he left for work. 13-year-old Tabitha always got herself off to school, and this day was no different. Tabitha left her home that morning and walked toward her bus stop, but then she disappeared. Police initially misclassified Tabitha as a runaway, but her family knew in their hearts that she didn't leave on her own. Was Tabitha abducted by a stranger or by someone whom she thought she could trust? 19 years later, her parents are still tirelessly searching for answers. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Tabitha Tudors. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Thank you so much for joining us once again. I know we're a little bit late, but I told you we would have this week's episode. But, you know, you got two this week, so I feel like it's all right.
Yeah, right?
I don't know.
Should be.
Yeah. And then people who are listening to this in the future are like, oh, God, what are you talking about? Just be quiet. So anyway, this week's episode is similar to that of Alexis Patterson, the little girl from Milwaukee who vanished on her way to school. I think as a parent, I was really drawn to this story because we have kids Tabitha's age, and the idea of them disappearing while doing something that they've done a million times before is, you know, terrifying.
Yeah, for sure. And the police, again, miscategorized it as, she ran away.
Yes, obviously. I mean, you know.
Easiest way out.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, let's get into it. This is the story of Tabitha Tudors. Tabitha Danielle Tudors was born on February 15th, 1990 in Nashville, Tennessee, to Beau and Deborah Tudors. She's the youngest of three children. Both of her siblings are significantly older. Her brother Kevin was 12 years older than her, and by 2003, when this is all happening, he was already out of the house. Her sister Jamie was 8 years older. And at this time, she was staying with the family. She also had children, and I think they were staying in the home as well at the time, but it was just like a temporary situation. Tabitha, who was nicknamed Boo by her family, was a bright, sweet kid. Her brother Kevin described her as a smiler who was always happy. And I mean, what wasn't there to be happy about? As the baby of the family, Tabitha was spoiled both by her siblings and her parents. In an episode of Disappeared, Deborah said that Tabitha would often end up sleeping in their room. She would go to bed, but when Deborah would wake up, Tabitha would be sleeping on the floor at the foot of their bed in like a little nest that she made out of blankets and pillows.
That's similar to our situation, except
I know.
He bullies his way in and makes sure that he wakes us up.
Yeah. You know. And just gets in bed in between us.
Yeah.
But it is similar because when Deborah, you know, would ask Tabitha like why she would do that, you know, she said she just wanted to be closer to them. Although what I will say is I think it was also, at least at this point, kind of practical because the house is like only a 2-bedroom house and her sister was like sleeping in her rooms. It was, you know, and if the kids were there, like it was pretty cramped. So she was probably just like, ugh, like I'm just going to go.
Yeah. I just need my own space.
Yeah. I'm going to go sleep in my nest. On April 29th, Tabitha was in a good mood. She had just gotten her report card, which had straight A's. So
nice.
She's very proud of herself. I don't want this to turn into one of those cliche, like she had a smile that lit up the room, you know, missing person stories, because I try to avoid doing that when I'm telling these. But this girl legitimately sounds like a saint. Like,
okay.
It's ridiculous. So I'm going to just read this entire paragraph from a Nashville Scene article that was published about her. Quote, Beau and Deborah paint a picture of a much loved daughter whose idea of mischief was, quote, cutting up and making people laugh, end quote. They recall a time when Tabitha was determined to bake her mother's homemade biscuits without assistance, and how she spent all afternoon methodically following the recipe, proudly serving them at dinner that night. That same year, when a neighbor's air conditioner broke in the sweltering summer, it was Tabitha who invited the woman and her dogs over to escape the heat. The young girl also befriended an elderly neighbor whom she affectionately called Grandma, visiting her often and reading to her a few times a week. End quote.
That can't be real.
I mean,
that's like the stuff of novels.
I know. But it's like everybody said basically the same thing about her. You know, obviously her family did, but like her homeroom teacher, you know, like all, you know, her friends, everybody said basically the same thing. Yeah, that just, that, as a parent of teenagers, I was just like, wow,
we dropped the ball.
Yeah, somewhere. As I mentioned in the intro, Tabitha always got herself off to school. Both of her parents had to go to work before she left the house, and her older sister, Jamie, was usually still asleep when Tabitha left. Each morning, Tabitha would walk a few blocks down to her bus stop at 14th and Boscobel Street. Though, you know, Tabitha knew not to talk to strangers and all of that, her parents also enacted another rule. She wasn't to wait at the bus stop alone. If Tabitha arrived at her stop and there weren't any kids there, then she was supposed to walk down to the next stop on 15th Street, which was more populated.
Do we know why this rule was enacted?
Yeah, and it wasn't because of any specific like reason, but East Nashville, where Tabitha and her family lived, was the poorer side of town and had a higher crime rate than other areas in the city. It was a little bit of a rough neighborhood where they lived, basically. So her parents just wanted her to remember that, you know, there are safety in numbers. Tabitha left her home as usual sometime after 7:30 that morning. Neighbors say that they saw her walking down her usual path to the bus stop, a journey that took her about 10 minutes. The last confirmed sighting of Tabitha was on Boscobel Street at about 7:50 a.m. And that was about 15 minutes before her bus typically arrived at 8:05. And apparently, and I actually read this like much later, another rule that her mom said was basically she didn't want her to get there more than like 10 minutes early either. You know, again, just to minimize the time where she's just hanging out on the street. So she was a little bit earlier than usual this morning, it sounds like. Witnesses say that Tabitha was looking at some papers in her hand, but didn't appear rushed or worried or anything like that. Nor did she seem to be looking for anyone. And a lot of people think that it was actually her report card that she was still looking at. Deborah worked as a lunch lady at an elementary school nearby. So she typically arrived home a few hours before Tabitha got off the bus at 4. So she had to go in early, but then she was home by like 1:30. She waited for Tabitha, and, you know, that's what they would always do. Like, that was their routine. Deborah would come home from work at around 1:30. She'd do whatever around the house, and she would be there when Tabitha got off the bus. So she waited for Tabitha that day, just like she always did, but 4 o'clock came, and no Tabitha. Deborah was worried within minutes. Tabitha was reliable, and she always came home on time. When Tabitha still didn't show up a few minutes later, she went to the bus stop just to see, like, maybe she was dawdling and, you know, talking to friends or something like that, but she wasn't there. Deborah then drove to her school, Bailey Middle School. By the time she arrived, you know, it was closer, it's like 4:30, 5 o'clock, and, you know, everybody had pretty much gone. So she, like, banged on a door and a janitor answered. He let her in. And, you know, she asked if there were any kids left there. And he said, oh, yeah, like there are a couple down, you know, wherever. So she went there, found a teacher and a few kids doing something. But Tabitha wasn't there. So she was finally able to find a staff member who could check attendance. And they informed her that Tabitha had never made it to school that day.
Yeah, this sounds really familiar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, the infuriating part of this is that the school never contacted the parents.
Right.
Tabitha had perfect attendance, but Despite that, her being gone without a note or a call didn't warrant anyone in the main office feeling as though they should pick up the phone.
I feel like we said this, you know, before.
Alexis's case.
Yeah, yeah. Like, regardless of your attendance record.
Yeah.
If a kid doesn't come to school, when our kids don't go to school and we forget to call them in sick, we get a phone call.
Yeah, immediately.
Yeah, like
within an hour, maybe two, right, of school starting.
Yeah, so like I don't understand why, you know, an absent student from school wouldn't warrant a phone call.
Yeah, and obviously there's a lot more technology, you know, now with our kids than there was when we were in school, or even in 2003 when this is happening. I mean, I also get email notifications if they miss a class or whatever.
A phone call.
Well, yeah,
in 2003 wasn't that long ago.
No, and you know, we were in school a little bit before that, and my school would still call.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, I assume yours would too. And
yeah, that's like, why I'd have to leave the house, wait for my parents to go to work, and mm-hmm. then come back and erase the message that the school left on the answering machine.
Ah.
Got to be smart.
Yeah.
This was before the days of Ring cameras and like, yeah. You know, so as soon as they left the house, I'd go back in.
Oh my God. Yeah, I just didn't skip school.
I did a lot of bad things.
I know.
But regardless, like,
yeah,
yes, it's when we were in
ridiculous. And this is after we graduated. Like,
right.
You know, like
this 2003,
is,
you said?
Yes.
Yeah. That's when we graduated college.
I
so,
know.
Like, the technology of phone calls and like automated messages or alerts or whatever to the teachers existed.
Yeah. So, you know, once Deborah found this whole thing out that Tabitha never arrived, then, I mean, that's obviously when the panic really sets in. So she called her husband and Jamie to see if anyone knew anything, like if maybe Tabitha had been sick and, you know, they had taken her somewhere and they just hadn't communicated or whatever. But, you know, of course they didn't. Deborah went back home to see if Tabitha had shown back up, but no trace of her. By 6 p.m., the tutors knew that their worst nightmare was beginning, and they called police to report Tabitha missing.
What was the time of the last confirmed sighting?
The last witness sighting. And so, we have to use the word confirmed loosely, right? So, like, her father left around 7 a.m.
Okay.
For work, you know, woke her up.
Right.
Made her cereal, whatever, and he left. So he saw her in the morning. And then we do have the last witness who says that they saw her was around 7:50 a.m.
Walking to her normal bus stop.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, looking completely fine and, you know.
And do we know, just out of curiosity, how far from the bus stop she was when the witness saw her?
I think she was close because she was at like the bus stop is on 14th and Boscobel Street. And so that person saw her on Boscobel Street and she lived on Lillian. So like that wasn't her street. So she must have been pretty close.
Okay. So something clearly happened at the bus stop or right around there.
That's what it would seem like. Yes.
Now, I may be jumping ahead here,
yeah.
But did the police interview the bus driver? Do we know, did she ever make it onto the bus?
It doesn't sound like it, no.
That she didn't make it onto the bus?
That she did not.
Not that the police didn't interview the bus driver.
Correct. I don't have any sources that explicitly talk about them interviewing the bus driver, but...
But one would assume if... she had made it to the bus and then still didn't make it into school, that probably would have come up in some news
exactly.
story.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. And that did not come up. So it doesn't sound like she ever got, and none of the kids ever say like, oh yeah, she was on the bus with me this morning, or, you know, she was at the bus stop or anything like that. So before we get into the investigation, it's important to realize that whomever took Tabitha under whatever circumstances had a 10-hour head start.
Right.
They had 10 hours to take her anywhere or to do whatever they wanted. When police arrived, they asked the normal questions, including what Tabitha was wearing that day. Unfortunately, nobody could answer that question.
Because nobody saw her change before she left the house to go to school.
Yeah. So Jamie, you know, like went into her room and basically tried to figure out what she had been wearing based on what was missing.
And she's a teenager?
Yeah, she's 13. Yeah, I mean,
good luck.
Exactly. It was not a fast or easy process from what it sounds like. And so eventually, and it did take them a while, like they didn't figure it out that night, you know, it certainly took a while. But by process of elimination, they figured that she was wearing jeans, a blue shirt, and white tennis shoes. Now, the way Nashville police handled this case is somewhat contradictory. Unsurprisingly, as I mentioned, they initially labeled Tabitha as a runaway, despite having no evidence of this.
Right.
And not only that, it's like, you know, what is it? The absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, like whatever that saying is. But regard,
I definitely don't think that's what the saying is, but okay.
I feel like it. I'll look it up. But they had a lot of evidence that pointed in the opposite direction. Not only was Tabitha a happy kid with a loving and supportive family, but from a practical standpoint, she didn't take anything with her. She didn't even have her backpack that morning. And that was something that was mentioned, which struck me as odd.
Right. Yeah.
But it
so
doesn't.
So here you have a straight A student.
Right.
Who's presumably, if we are to believe the witness, remembers from the correct day, went to school.
Yeah.
And didn't have her backpack with her.
I know.
It seems odd.
It did strike me as odd too, but it didn't seem to strike the family as odd. So I don't know. So maybe she just didn't always take her backpack. Maybe she didn't. I don't know. But yeah, that struck me, but it didn't seem to really strike anybody else. So it seems like maybe that was normal for her. Like the other thing was she didn't take her house key with her, but Deborah said that that was also normal because she was always there when Tabitha got home, so she didn't need it.
Right. The backpack troubles me.
I know. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's weird. And it was only mentioned kind of in passing. Nobody, like I said, seemed to think it was a big deal.
If she is somebody that that takes her backpack to school every day.
Yeah.
Her backpack being at home, to me, indicates that the witness did have the wrong day and she was abducted somewhere closer to the house.
Yeah. Or she wasn't planning on going to school that day, perhaps.
Right. Yes.
But to that point, you know, because obviously that's what the police are thinking, like maybe she wasn't planning on going to school for whatever reason. You know, yeah, she didn't have her backpack, but when police searched her room, they also found that she didn't take like anything else. So they found her makeup. They found, you know, basically all of her clothes. That's why it took so long for them to figure out, you know, what she was wearing, because pretty much everything was there. And she also had $20 in cash, and that was like all the money she had. So you would think that if you're doing basically anything that's not going to school, you would take your money with you, but she didn't. And, you know, she also had plans. Like she was supposed to help a friend babysit that afternoon after school. And that, you know, she was excited, like she was excited about. They were talking about it like the day before. Everything was cool there. And she also had a trip to Six Flags planned 2 weeks later, which she was super excited about. So again, like there's just nothing indicating that she would have run away. But despite this, you know, that's what police thought. And so partially because of this, they did not issue an Amber Alert for her.
Isn't the age also an issue for the Amber Alert?
Or is 13's well within the Amber Alert. Yeah, Amber Alerts can go up to 19, I believe.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, although again, Amber Alert criteria does vary state by state. And in fairness, Tennessee seems to have been one of those states that requires proof of an abduction, meaning like they need a car, they need a license plate, they need something like that in order to issue an Amber Alert.
Seems dumb to me, but okay.
Right. And again, I mean, that's the thing. Like, it varies state by state. And so that was a big thing with the Michael Vaughn disappearance. You know, even though he was only five, like, they didn't have any hard proof, quote unquote,
that he was abducted.
Yeah. Right. And so to this day, there's never been an Amber Alert, but they did do other alerts for him. And
so did they do the same thing?
Yeah, that's what they did in this case too. So they sent her information in the form of a bulletin to the local news station. And so the, like, just a basic information about her disappearance did air on the 10 o'clock news, and it continued to get picked up locally the next day.
Well, I mean, that's something.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for sure. Now, I don't have the exact timing of this, but a search of the 5-mile radius around Tabitha's house was done pretty quickly after her disappearance as well. According to an episode of the Unsolved Mysteries podcast, Nashville Metro Police knocked on doors and searched nearby bodies of water. There were also dogs that were, like, search dogs that were brought out as well.
So they're doing all of this pretty quickly, it sounds like.
Yes.
But they still classified her as a runaway and continued to do the investigation?
From what it sounds like, certain officers had different opinions about what had happened. And I'll kind of get into that a little bit, but there doesn't seem to be, like, the Metro Nashville Police Department just never really seemed to be on the same page about this case.
But somebody was initiating the standard or typical procedures for a missing person versus a runaway.
Right, right. Correct. Now, it was during all of this, like this initial search, when they were, you know, asking the public for information, et cetera, that they found the witnesses who had seen Tabitha that morning. So there was that neighbor who saw her at 7:50, but then there was a kid, one of her, you know, who also went to the middle school, he was like 11, who was at the second bus stop on 15th Street, and he had a very interesting story. According to him, he saw Tabitha that morning around her 14th Street bus stop. He then saw a sporty red car pull up that appeared to have been driven by a black man aged 30 to 40 wearing a baseball cap. He said that Tabitha got into the car, at which point the car reversed and went back up the hill where it came from. Now, this kid was a block away, so I'm not sure how much weight can be put into the details of his sighting, but the search dogs that came out later did back up the general idea of it, because, like, they followed her scent in the general route that he had described. Alarmingly, the dogs also traced her scent into an alley, a place that Tabitha's friends said she never would have gone into alone. This was the first solid lead that anyone had in relation to Tabitha's disappearance. Her parents, though, were adamant that she would never get into a car with a stranger, so that left them with people that she knew and felt comfortable with. Tabitha's family is white, so it wasn't any of them. But there was one person in their life who did fit the general description, and that was Jamie's ex-boyfriend. And some reports have said that it's ex-boyfriend or current boyfriend. I know that, you know, she ended up getting married to somebody completely different after all this, but I'm not entirely sure what their relationship status was at the time. But at one point, he had lived with the Tudors. So, like, Jamie and her kids were staying with the Tudors, and at some point, this guy had been staying there for a little while, too. So he knew Tabitha. He knew her schedule. You know, she was presumably comfortable with him. And so he is somebody that she would have theoretically been comfortable enough with to get into a car. But, you know, that's really all it seems like they had on him. He fit the definition of a random black guy who fits the description, you know?
Well, I mean, does he have a red car?
Well, this is what's killing me. So the very first time I heard about this case was from that episode of Disappeared. And that aired in 2018. And I get to this like at the end of the episode. And so whoever the cold case detective assigned to this at that time, you know, was extensively in the episode. And he said that police were never able to find any evidence that tied him to this, the most important being the red car.
Right.
The detective said, like, he didn't have a red car. They couldn't find anybody in, like, his family or whatever who had a red car that he could have borrowed. So that was big. And then he also was interviewed and given a polygraph, and he passed, and Jamie vouched for him, you know, in terms of not necessarily like, I know where he was at the time.
Yeah, not an alibi, but.
Yeah,
not.
But like character witnessy kind of vouching.
Well, so it's interesting that you mentioned that the child witness was, you said, a block away.
Yeah.
So, I mean, isn't it reasonable to say that maybe he got the race of the individual behind the wheel wrong?
Yeah, potentially.
So maybe it was a white guy in a red car?
I mean, maybe. But I think it's certainly more, you know, likely that maybe, you know, the person was Hispanic or some other race that, you know, maybe looked like a black person from a distance. I don't know. But, you know, theoretically, yeah, it could have all been.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know what angle he was looking at.
No.
Was he looking through the windshield or the driver's side or even passenger side
window? Yeah.
Side window. Was there a tint? We don't know those details.
No.
So perfectly reasonable that he could have just had his description wrong.
Sure. No, it is. It really is. So while this whole thing was going on and they're, you know, interviewing the ex-boyfriend and whatever, police also started looking into the neighbors. Tabitha's neighborhood was known for being working class, but it also had its share of sex offenders and other criminals. One of their neighbors, Millard Earl Smith, was arrested just a few months after Tabitha's disappearance after he lured a young boy who, like Tabitha, attended Bailey Middle School onto his motorcycle. He then took the boy into the woods and attempted to sexually assault him. Fortunately, the boy was able to escape unharmed. They did not catch Smith then, and so 1 month later, he lured a girl from a Greyhound station and raped her at knife point. Now, this girl was able to get his license plate number, and then they brought the boy in to see if he could pick him out of a lineup, and they both picked out Miller Earl Smith from lineups. And then she was given a rape kit after her attack, and so they had DNA as well. A couple who lived just a few doors down from the Tudors were arrested shortly after her disappearance for raping a minor. Apparently, their son walked in on them and was the one who called police.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Also, like, what the fuck is going on in this neighborhood?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it is East Nashville. It's like, it's city, you know, we're not talking about the suburbs here. And it is like a rough area. And yeah, it just apparently had its share of criminals and sex offenders.
I mean, I get crime, but like a concentration of sex offenders?
Yeah.
Yikes.
Then there was the maintenance worker. Now this guy
at the school?
No, that's just his general job. And this guy's never named. When I was researching this story, I went to one of my favorite sites, Web Sleuths, and they had a thread on Tabitha's case from back in 2003. So I was able to get contemporaneous information. And even better, a man named Johnny White, who was a family friend and ended up kind of serving as the spokesperson for the Tudors, he was on the board and he was posting very frequently. So this maintenance worker, he started out as a witness. He told police that he had seen Tabitha on the corner of 14th and Lillian the morning that she disappeared. Now, Lillian is a street that she lives on, and then 14th Street was the first bus stop. He said that this sighting took place after he had picked up a high school kid from his bus stop on 19th and Shelby and was driving him to school.
Why was he driving some random kid to school?
Well, yeah, obviously that's everybody's first question. But then also, like, the timing did not make any sense in terms of the two bus stop locations and when those buses would have arrived and when the kids would have been at those stops. So, like, because I think he was saying that this kid missed his bus, but, like, his bus wouldn't have come by then. You know, it was just, like, the timing just did not make sense to people. But, you know, people get dates and times mixed up all the time in situations like this. Like, so maybe he was thinking of a different day or, you know, whatever. But to your point, investigators did not like the fact that this dude had just randomly picked up a high school kid and drove him to school. So as they kind of looked into him, they found that he had a habit of befriending children in the neighborhood. Like, he would buy them bicycles, he would take them fishing. One of these kids that this maintenance man befriended was one of Tabitha's former best friends, though she and Tabitha had like some sort of falling out a while back. But by all accounts, Tabitha like wasn't friends or whatever with this guy. Like, she didn't go fishing with him. Like, they did not interact at all. But in August of 2003, he gave a disturbing interview to Nashville Scene in which he spoke about Tabitha in a very familiar and crude way. He literally was just talking to this reporter and talked about how Tabitha was beginning to develop physically, like with hand gestures.
No, that's disturbing.
Incredibly. Like, the reporter was like, what? He also speculated that Tabitha may not have been as sweet and innocent as she seemed.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So, like, red flag, red flag, red flag.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all very, very bad. So after this, the man became the main person of interest in Tabitha's case for obvious reasons.
Yeah, right. As well, he should be.
Yeah. So then that September, Nashville police executed a search warrant on his home. The search was characterized as aggressive and included the use of luminol in hopes of finding blood evidence. But nothing came of it, and suspicion around him eventually lessened. Although I should mention, too, that this guy was like married and had a kid or more kids. And around this time, there was a, you know, Department of Child Services investigation into the home as well. So I don't know what that was about or what came of it, but not great. Now, even though there was a large search in the first 72 hours of police getting Tabitha's case, and there was a subsequent investigation into the people around her, several officers still stated publicly that they believed Tabitha was a troubled teen who decided to leave home. And so that's what I meant where, like, it didn't seem like people within the department were on the same page. So it sounds like, from what I was reading, it was just situations in which there would be a search or there would be whatever, and reporters would be there and they'd, you know, find a cop and try to get a comment, and they would just talk to the reporters and say stuff like this.
All right, well, that's some pretty terrible training on the the police department's part. Cops shouldn't just be randomly speaking to,
like, their theory on like who care. I mean, you know, obviously a lot of people care, but it's like, dude, just don't. Why? No.
Well, yeah, I mean, if these are like cops that are involved in a search, they're obviously not privy to the majority of the information mm-hmm. on the case. They're just, you know, bodies, their eyes and ears,
yeah,
conducting a search. Like, they don't know anything about it. They just know there's a missing kid.
But I think that what hurt this case from the very beginning is the fact that Tabitha lived in this neighborhood. She had very working class, like, not super educated parents. And I think that there were a lot of assumptions made about her and her family that very much were not true. And I think that that really slowed things down. And it wasn't just Tabitha's family who didn't believe she had run away, because, you know, like, the family's never going to believe that. But no one who knew her did. Her homeroom teacher even told Nashville Scene that she never believed for a moment that Tabitha had run away. She never saw indications of a bad home life or any other warning signs that may have indicated that she was thinking of running off. Like, this girl volunteered in the library with her best friend basically every day, and they would fight over who got to use the electric stapler. Which I get, because that thing is fun as hell. And apparently Tabitha always won. The only thing that may have indicated that Tabitha had more going on privately was a card that police found when they did the initial search of her bedroom. It was made like a business card and had several pastel colors and heart-shaped balloons. On one side is a picture of Winnie the Pooh holding a heart-shaped pillow. The card has Tabitha's name, address, and phone number on it, with "Call Me" written below. It also had the words "sexy girl" like handwritten on it, but that was crossed out and replaced with the words "ghetto girl." Police found several of these cards in a bowl on her dresser.
And they all had the same thing written in them?
Well, so that's not clear. I don't know if like the handwritten part of it was on all of them or not, or if it was just the one.
It's very bizarre.
Yeah. Now, this didn't become public, though, until August of 2003, like 4 months after she went missing. Once it did become public, reporters asked Tabitha's mom, Deborah, about it. And Deborah said, quote, "I remember seeing one in her room and they took it. She just had it in her desk. She never used it or nothing like that," end quote. Now, the cards led to a lot of speculation on the Web Sleuths forum, and Johnny White, the family friend slash spokesperson, came back with more information. He said, quote, "A girl printed them up for Tabitha at school, we believe. The name Sexy Girl was put on them by the girl, and Tabitha scratched it out with an ink pen and wrote in Ghetto Girl. Several of these were found, and they had her teacher's name on them as well," end quote. Now, the teacher thing makes me think that it started out as like some sort of school project that the kids just wrote dumb things on, because I can see at that age and at that time, 2003, part of what you would be learning is like computers, right? And like how to make, you know, business cards or greeting cards or posters or invitations or things on the computer. Like I definitely remember having to do things like that in school.
Not in 2003.
Not in 2003, in the 90s, but still, I mean, I still think that that's a thing, right? And so to me, that's what it struck me as, that it started out as just something that she was doing in school for a class. And then, you know, kids just do shit.
Right.
Now, the reason this ended up coming out in August is because police sent a letter to the school with a photo of the card in hopes of finding out, you know, more about it, like where it came from, if it came from the school, if anybody knew, like whatever, whatever. And the letter also asked teachers and students to report anything, quote, "no matter how small or insignificant," end quote, to police. And, you know, the letters made the kids really sad because Tabitha still hadn't been found, but it doesn't seem as though any more useful information came out of it. It does sound, like I said, you know, they got the information about the card and who wrote "sexy girl" on it and all of that. But in terms of anything beyond that, it doesn't sound like they got it. As I mentioned, police did have this card from the very beginning, but waited nearly 4 months before they sent this letter out. This was seemingly a last-ditch effort to garner more clues after an extensive search the previous month failed to turn anything up. 11 weeks after Tabitha's disappearance, police brought out dogs and did a thorough search of each residential street in the area where she was last seen. They also did a search of Shelby Bottoms Greenway on July 29th. Shelby Bottoms Greenway is a natural area located in East Nashville that's over 5 miles long. By this time, the public sentiment in Nashville was turning against the police, specifically toward Deborah Faulkner, who was serving as interim chief at the time. In a conversation with an AP reporter, she was asked about their seemingly slow response. Her reply? Basically blaming the family.
Jesus. Like, why do we keep having these same themes come up in different cases? Like,
I mean, I don't know. It almost seems as if the same type of people decide to go into law enforcement.
Or there's a complete lack of training and understanding of what to do in a missing persons case.
Yeah. Or, and in the training that does happen, everyone kind of gets the same training, right? And so if it's inadequate, if it's not good, if it's whatever, like, everybody's getting it.
I just don't understand why you would ever... If you've gotten to the point in the investigation where the family has been alibied or ruled out as suspects,
yeah,
like, why would you then,
yeah, I mean, everybody was
further,
like,
down the line,
yeah,
alienate them further and say that they were hemming up the investigation?
No. So, well, they didn't say that they were, like, currently hemming up the investigation, just that they did at the beginning. So let me get to the specifics of what she said. She told this reporter, quote, "It took 3 days to nail down with the family what she had on when she was missing," end quote.
Okay, but, like, look at the fucking timeline.
Yeah.
Of the events leading up to, like, a normal day of her going to school.
Yeah.
And that explains why they wouldn't know what the hell she was wearing.
Exactly. I mean, it's not as though... they saw her and they sent her off to the school bus and were just like, oh, I don't know.
Right.
We never looked. Like, there was a very clear and obvious reason why nobody knew and why it took them a while to figure it out. But the chief didn't stop there. She also said, well, you know, we weren't notified that she was missing until 11 hours after she was gone.
Because nobody knew she was missing, because the school never called the parents to say she hadn't made it to school that day.
Exactly. In reality, police were notified within, like, an hour of when anybody knew that something was wrong.
Right.
But if you just say it was 11 hours, which is technically true, it doesn't make you look as bad. Faulkner even complained that the photo that the family initially gave them was outdated. This was 2003. Digital cameras certainly existed, but they were not common. They were very expensive at that time. They weren't really on phones, like the first camera phones, as we called them at the time. Like, we're coming out.
Yeah, but nobody had them.
I mean, very few people did. Yeah. And, like, most people were still using the Nokia bricks.
I mean, shit, there was a lot of people that still just didn't have
phones,
cell phones.
Period. Yeah, no, absolutely.
I didn't have a cell phone in 2003.
I did. But you're right, though. There are a lot of people who didn't. So people just didn't have the number of photos of, like, their kids,
right,
and stuff like they do now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, okay. I'm sure they, like, gave them the best photo that they could, but, like, it's just not reasonable to expect them to have, like, a super up-to-date photo. Unfortunately, you know, obviously, yes, from a logistical place, yes, it is, of course, better to have an updated photo, but the fact that they didn't is not a bad mark on the family.
Right, yeah, it's not indicative of them somehow hindering the investigation or slowing it down or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, they're providing you with everything that they can.
Right. And it's so frustrating. And I think why a lot of people found this particularly frustrating is because people understand that missing persons cases in general, and especially something like this, where there are just so few actual clues to go on, it's not shocking that this wasn't solved right away.
Right.
But when you're the interim chief and you're telling reporters stuff like that, it does not make you look good.
No. Yeah. It's funny because I'm sure in her mind when she was saying these things, the interim chief,
yeah,
she was defending her department.
Yeah.
Great. but it does the opposite.
Yeah. You look like a fucking tool.
Right. Yeah. You look like you're coming up with excuses as to why, and you're blaming other people as to why you haven't solved the case.
Yeah.
Whereas you could just simply say, this is a difficult case. We've had some setbacks.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Like, we are starting from a position of weakness due to these circumstances.
Right.
That were out of our control and out of the family's control.
Right.
You know, people get it. Like, people get that.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, she sucked. And so it didn't work out for her. People did not like her. They weren't super fond of the department in general. But, you know, police did continue to run down leads, including like sightings out of state. There were a lot of them, from what it sounds like. Several in Indiana, like, you know, along highways. So sex trafficking has always been a potential in this situation, because sure, there a lot of times when that does come up in cases, I'm kind of like, oh, it's more like wishful thinking than anything else. But I think in this case, there actually was a fair amount of sex trafficking in the area at that time. So while Tabitha certainly did not have any of the warning signs of somebody who was vulnerable to being put in a situation like that,
right,
I won't say it's outside of the realm of possibility.
Yeah.
None of these sightings ever panned out. And, you know, Tabitha, though, was featured on billboards. She was in a segment of America's Most Wanted. And the reward for information was raised to $20,000, but still nothing. By January of 2004, Faulkner was out as interim chief and apparently didn't even make the shortlist for the permanent position.
Weird.
Yeah. So apparently the mayor ended up appointing the full-time chief.
Uh-huh.
And it went to a man named Ronald Serpas, who immediately put out a statement saying he didn't believe that Tabitha was a runaway. He also met with the tutors, something that Faulkner never bothered to do. Despite Chief Serpas publicly stating that this investigation was going to be a top priority for his department, it seems as though Metro Police interest soon faded once again. The Tennessean, which is like the big newspaper there, did cover Tabitha's case, but Nashville Scene, which I've already mentioned several times in this, and it sounds like they're really more of an alt weekly, they've come up more because they really covered this case extensively. And, you know, because it's an alt weekly and not like your typical newspaper, like, it's a lot more opinion. It's more like reading like a blog than it is a newspaper. Like, it's a lot more opinion driven. And so they like really did not hold back on their opinions about the investigation or anything. Just to give you an idea, here's a paragraph from an editorial that ran on the 1 year anniversary of Tabitha's disappearance. Quote, "It's difficult to identify any aspect of the investigation that the department has handled well. Detectives have been slow to interview suspects, track leads, keep the family informed, and interview people who best knew the missing girl, whose 14th birthday came and went in February. There's no clear sense among the family and media about who's in charge of the case. It's almost as if the department wishes that people would stop caring about the fate of the young teen who woke up on a Tuesday morning, walked toward her bus stop, and vanished." End quote. I want to say it was the day before she disappeared, but it might have been 2 days before, because like the day she disappeared, the Monday, it would have made it the Monday. But like, Tabitha spent the night at a friend's house, and her friend's dad drove her home in the morning or whatever. And so other than her parents, he was like the last adult to see her. And he wasn't interviewed for like months after her disappearance.
Okay, wait, this is the morning of her disappearance or the night before?
No, before. Yeah, like okay. The day before. Even though the police did seem to do like a relatively thorough investigation, the scene and many others criticized the amount of time that it took. The comprehensive search with dogs, it was 11 weeks after she went missing that they did this. The dogs that I mentioned that came out initially were from a volunteer organization.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
even the creepy maintenance man who said that Tabitha may not be as innocent as she seemed and claimed to see her that day, police knew about him from the beginning because neighbors and stuff were like, dude, you need to look at this guy. He's a creep. But they still didn't seriously interview him until several months after Tabitha's disappearance. There was even a sex worker who went to one of the volunteers searching for Tabitha and told them that she and a client from Kingsport, Tennessee, drove through East Nashville, including Lillian Street, where Tabitha lived. The guy had a computer in his car and told her that he was looking to pick up a young girl named Tabby. So the volunteer immediately gave this tip to police, but has no idea if they ever followed up. Another thing that I learned from this article that really broke my heart was that not too long before her disappearance, Tabitha wasn't a straight-A student. Like, she still got decent grades and everything because she was smart, but she wasn't aiming to achieve as much as she could. And her parents sat her down one day and really stressed the importance of her getting her education because they were both high school dropouts. And it was because of that talk that Tabitha buckled down and earned that straight-A report card that she was so proud of the morning that she went missing. By the one-year mark, the tips had slowed to a trickle, and though volunteers were still performing searches, the mood was clearly growing more somber as the months went on. One interesting thing did happen on the eve of the one-year anniversary, and that was that a person of interest in the case, and there were many, like I said, in this neighborhood, there are a lot of persons of interest.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah. So one of them, Ernest Fred Brown, who, again, was a neighbor, crashed his car near Tabitha's bus stop. And again, this is like the eve of the one-year anniversary. And, you know, I almost didn't include this because, like, whatever. I mean,
wait, is there more to it other than him crashing?
Well, yeah, because it didn't seem like there was.
That doesn't seem like that would matter.
Well, exactly.
Or be connected.
Right. And so that's why I almost didn't even include it. But then I read this part. Tabitha's mother, Deborah, said that Brown had been driving very fast in front of her house that day. It was to the point where family members confronted him and asked him to slow down because they had children playing. And then the crash happened shortly thereafter.
There's still no connection to her missing.
No, there isn't. But I don't love the fact that a person of interest in her case was like recklessly driving in front of the house on the 1 year anniversary.
Yeah, no, I mean, I get that, but do we know why he was a person of interest in the case?
Well, yeah. So after I read the quote from Deborah, I'm like, okay, well, let me actually look at that. Like, this does seem a little bit more interesting than I initially thought. So, you know, like I said, it could be nothing, but Brown was arrested after the crash because he ran away.
As you do.
Yeah. And so police used this as an opportunity to question him about Tabitha. Now, to be clear, he had been on the radar for quite a while at this point and had previously been questioned in her disappearance. But he didn't confess or anything that night, so like he was released. But then Brown gave an interview to reporters the next day.
Dude, people in this town need to stop talking to the reporters.
I know, but actually in this case, I think it weirdly might have been a good idea. He said that it was just a coincidence that the crash happened right by Tabitha's bus stop. He said that he was out driving crazy because he was looking for a bike that had been stolen from his girlfriend's son. Brown initially became a person of interest because neighbors told police they should look into him. Neighbors were like, yeah, this kid. So he was only 22 at this time, and 1 year later, so he was like 21 when Tabitha disappeared, but he already had an extensive criminal record. So that's basically why, right? Like, so neighbors are like, hey, there's this like punk ass kid who lives in the neighborhood who's always in trouble. Like,
right.
Take a look at him.
Yeah.
You know? But his record wasn't violent crimes. It was car theft. It was driving without a license. You know, it was stuff like that. But he had also driven a red Chrysler LeBaron.
Mm-hmm.
And that classmate said that Tabitha had gotten into a red car the morning she disappeared. And Brown had later scrapped that car, which obviously police found suspicious. So it makes sense that he became a person of interest in this case. So the day after this crash, when he was speaking to reporters, he freely admitted that he had both drug and mental health problems. It's like, yeah, but like, listen, he's like, I got my issues, but I'm not a killer. And, you know, okay, like, sure. But I do kind of buy it because also, I don't know, it's just like the way that they all said it, because it's like, yeah, you would expect, you say that you're not a killer, and you would expect his mother and grandmother to also say that he's not a killer. But his mom said that he couldn't be guilty, not because he's like a good person, but because he's terrible at keeping secrets.
Okay.
And then his grandmother said, quote, he can't keep nothing to himself, end quote.
Well, I mean.
And then Brown agreed with her, saying, quote, I'd even snitch on myself, end quote. Honestly, I believe it. Because this guy seems like a fuck up, but not an abduct a child and leave no clues for a year type of guy.
Right.
You know, like that's a different skill set. And he didn't even really have the skill set for what he was doing, much less this.
Right.
And he was literally arrested 2 weeks later for breaking into a car by his house. So, I mean, come on.
Yeah, not exactly the criminal mastermind.
No. Leads continued to come in as the years went on, and the tutors still stayed in their same home just in case their daughter came back. They said it was the only home she'd ever known, and they thought about moving, but ultimately they just couldn't. Now, what seemed to be a potential big break came in 2020 when police were given a tip about a piece of property in Centerville, Tennessee, that belonged to one of those many persons of interest in Tabitha's case. This man is named Albert Franklin Jr. And at this time in 2020, police started calling him the number one person of interest in Tabitha's case. And he is a black man who does like fit the general description of the person that the student saw in the car. According to WKRN, he also owned a trailer park a few miles away from Tabitha's home that was known for its vice activity. An extensive search was done of the property, though, that was in a different county, and it was about 6 acres and had like a dilapidated, abandoned house on it. And I believe the search was like a 2-day search, but unfortunately, it seems like they came up empty. Now, the tutors didn't know this man. He was not in their lives or anything like that. They knew of him because his name came up in the early days of the investigation. Apparently, a lot of tips had come in about Tabitha being seen at the trailer park. And there was also a rumor that I read in like one thing. And again, it just seems very, very, very much like a rumor that Tabitha would like smoke cigarettes with this guy. But again, like there's literally no evidence that I could see that's true. Now, Franklin is currently serving a 37-year prison sentence for federal firearm and drug charges.
Yeah, that'll get you.
Like, there are kind of two schools of thought, right? There's a school of thought that if the rumor about her smoking cigarettes with him or whatever was true, then he would be potentially somebody she would get into a car with. The second train of thought is he's in prison on weapons charges. If he had a weapon, like, did he force her into the car?
Right.
And then again, we get back to the whole theory of sex trafficking. It sounds like there was activity related to that going on at his trailer park. He had drug charges too. So one of the big prevailing theories is that Tabitha was abducted and drugged and then
trafficked.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. So this kind of does fit with several possible theories in this case. And so as far as I'm aware, like as of right now, this guy is still their main person of interest, but it doesn't seem like anything's really happened with him since this search in 2020. Now, in terms of the general feeling around town, it seems like people still think that Jamie's ex-boyfriend is the most likely suspect.
Once again, because he's black?
I mean, part of, yeah. I mean, that's definitely a big reason. So there's that. But, and there were even questions about Jamie herself for a time, because three of the four polygraphs that she took initially, you know, they came back inconclusive. And at one point, I think detectives said that she like failed. But she told Nashville Scene that she failed, or, you know, whatever, because the detectives were extremely aggressive with her. Mm. She said, quote, "The very first detective who ever talked to me told me that they were going to take my kids away if I failed those tests. He said that my family and everybody else was going to see me on the news," end quote.
Wow.
Yeah.
So like treated her as a suspect right away.
Yeah.
To do this test that would eliminate her as a
right.
suspect.
Like the test that measures stress responses.
Yeah, right. That's smart.
Yeah. So yeah, maybe it's not completely objective at that point when you're like threatening this woman with taking away her children, like after her sister has just been apparently abducted.
Right.
Jamie also said that she never believed her ex had anything to do with her sister's disappearance. But the thing about this ex that is interesting is that, you know, when I talked about him in the beginning of the episode, I talked to you about the detective from the disappeared episode in 2018 who said that they were never able to like connect him to a red car. However, in this article that, you know, I'm getting like this information about the polygraphs and everything, it's from 2008. So 5 years after Tabitha's disappearance, about 10 years before the disappeared episode. And so like different officers are on, different detectives are on the case, you know, like it's a whole different thing. But that friend and family spokesperson, Johnny White, he said that the boyfriend had gotten off of work at 7 o'clock that morning and was driving a red car. So I don't know. I mean, it's so hard to say because so many different people have been involved in this case over the years, and it doesn't sound like a lot of them have like a really solid grasp on the facts. So on one hand, Johnny White is not police. He was not in the investigation. He's not an investigator.
Right.
But he was very close to it. Mm-hmm. So it's like, is he right? Is he wrong? It's hard to say. You could, you know, argue either way. Then you have a detective in 2018 saying that they were never able to connect the ex-boyfriend to a red car. But then the Unsolved Mysteries podcast.
Did.
Yeah. Like in 2020, 2021, like that, whenever that aired, that it might have even aired this year in 2022. It's like recent. That detective, who's a different detective, so that there was a red car.
Right.
But he, if you listen to the episode, was very much like, yeah, and I believe he did have a red car. Like, he did not sound sure of himself at all. And not just with that, like, just in general. Like, he very much sounded like a person who was asked to be on this podcast and, like, read the case file the day before and, like, went into the interview. I did not get the impression that he was, like, deeply entrenched in this case. So like, I don't know how much stock to put in that. So yeah. So, I mean, to me, the ex-boyfriend and whether or not he could have been involved and whether or not he did have the car or anything else to tie him, you know, is just really up in the air. Because again, I've also heard different stories about what he did for a living at the time. You know, Johnny said in this article that he had gotten off of work at 7. He worked at a retail store. Like, I think he worked overnights, like stocking or whatever. But then I read something else that said he worked for like the Park Service and he had lots of access to open land, which is why other people found him suspicious. So like, which was it, you know?
I mean, what if it was both?
It might have been, but like, that's not clear. And so I don't know how much stock to put in anything around this guy. It's just been nearly 20 years of confusion and people not being on the same page and dead ends, but the Tudors haven't given up on finding their daughter. A banner with Tabitha's missing persons poster still hangs on their front porch, and they still celebrate her birthday every year. Deborah and Beau tell their grandchildren about the aunt that they never met. Deborah even told reporters recently that she still feels Tabitha with her. Quote, "I'll be driving by myself and I can hear her. And then when I look in the passenger seat, I can see her sitting there just singing." End quote. Detectives say that they still believe someone or someones in the Nashville area know what happened to Tabitha. They just need the right person to come forward. Tabitha Tudors has been missing from Nashville, Tennessee since April 29, 2003. She was a white female with sandy blonde hair and blue eyes. At the time of her disappearance, she was 4'9" to 5'1" and around 98 pounds. She has a birthmark on her stomach and a scar on her finger. Tabitha was 13 when she went missing. She would be 32 today. If you have any information regarding the disappearance of Tabitha Tudors, please call the Nashville Metro Police Department at 615-862-8600. There is a $50,000 reward in her case. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains May 2nd through the 12th. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.